Kai Bird had an unusual childhood as the son of a diplomat. He grew up during the conflicts in the Middle East that began in Jordanian East Jerusalem in 1956, Saudi Arabia, Egypt in 1967, briefly in Lebanon. In his latest book, Crossing Mandelbaum Gate, he explores his own identity and also the implications of the Shoah, Hebrew for the Holocaust, and the Nakba, which is Arabic for the catastrophe, the Palestinians' description of the founding of Israel. Crossing Mandelbaum Gate is published by Scribner, an imprint of Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it brings the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Kai Bird back to our show. Hi.
Thank you.
After writing historical biographies about Cold War figures like Robert Oppenheimer, McGeorge Bundy, why did you finally decide to write about your own childhood and the years you spent in the Middle East?
Well, Leonard, I actually tried to avoid the subject for a long time. I grew up in the Middle East my whole childhood in all these different countries and cities. And I tried as a young man, as a reporter, to occasionally write about it. And every time I did, I found it very painful. It's an emotional black hole. It's always controversial. But actually, in 1990-91, when the first Persian Gulf War occurred, I had a rush of sort of childhood memories coming back. And I sat down and I wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post, in which I talked about some of my earliest memories, crossing Mandelbaum Gate, which was this very scary, grim crossing point between a very divided Jerusalem, West Jerusalem, and being in Israel, and East Jerusalem, then being part of Jordan. And because I was the privileged son of a diplomat, where we lived in East Jerusalem, I nevertheless went to school in West Jerusalem, so I went back and forth through this Mandelbaum Gate.
But people on one side could not cross.
No Israelis could go to Jordan, and no Jordanians or Palestinians could cross into Israel, of course.
Well, so much of this is about the conflict between Arabs and Israelis. Did you ever live in Israel?
I didn't actually ever live in Israel. I would drive through the gate and go down to the beaches of Tel Aviv and swim in the Mediterranean, and I traveled in Israel as a young man.
Didn't you go to school there at one point?
I went to school in Israel, yes.
But it's interesting that no matter where you seem to go in the Middle East, Israel is always a presence.
Always a presence, yes.
Why is that? Was the hostility to Israel's existence the same no matter where you lived?
It was. You know, I grew up among the Arabs, whether it was in Egypt in the 2 years leading up to the 67 war or among the Palestinians in East Jerusalem in the period 56 to 58 and then in Saudi Arabia. And yes, the Arabs did not understand why the existence of Israel had suddenly come into their world. They didn't understand why all these refugees from the Shoah had turned up on Arab lands and created this very Western foreign state.
Well, but many people have pointed out that happened 62 years ago, and actually it was in the works even before. And yet it's just, for many people, it's just as though it happened yesterday.
Yeah, absolutely. It's
Why hasn't time healed any of the wounds, do you think?
I think because these two peoples, the Arabs, particularly the Palestinians and the Israelis, have two very competing, different, contradictory historical narratives. And neither side can see the other. I chose the title Crossing Mandelbaum Gate from my memoir because it implies that I was able to see both sides. And indeed, I in a metaphorical sense, I had another crossing of Mandelbaum Gate when I fell in love with my wife, Susan, who's not only Jewish but is the only daughter of two Holocaust survivors. And so in this book, I really do try to see both sides, unlike the Israelis or the Palestinians, who really just see their own narratives only.
Well, we're an American, an outsider, and a Protestant. I don't know whether that mattered because there are a fair number of Christians in the area as well, and they get caught up in the conflict too, don't they?
Yes, they do. There were, in the Jerusalem of my youth, there were many Christian Palestinians, Greek Orthodox, Armenian.
Who have their own agendas.
Who have their own agendas and their own troubled histories. And
what was your father's job?
Well, initially in Jerusalem, this was his first posting. He was simply a lowly vice consul. He was stamping visas. And ironically, we learned years later, after Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated by Sirhan, My father was apparently the consul who stamped Sir Hans' visa to come to America when he was 12 years old.
As you describe it, an important part of what he did was to go to cocktail parties.
That's right.
How important is the social scene in the life of a diplomat?
Oh, it's real work. It's not frivolous. It's sometimes tedious. But my father actually enjoyed it. He's a very gregarious man. He's still alive. He loves meeting new people, and he grew to love the Middle East. And part of his job was going to cocktail parties and finding new sources.
Whenever there's a crisis, we get here in the news of people being evacuated, Americans being evacuated. The first time that happened with you was in 1956. How long after you arrived?
Oh, just literally within a couple of months after our arrival in Jerusalem, my mother and my younger sister and I were whisked out on the last plane, in this case to Beirut, because of the outbreak of war, the Sinai-Suez War of 1956. And then we were evacuated again for the war, the June 67 war, from Cairo, this time to Athens. I sort of describe in the book how I'm like this Leonard Zelig-like figure, you know, from the Woody Allen film, where I keep popping up here and there in different to witness history.
But you were sent to Beirut because that was considered the safest city at the time, called the Paris of the Middle East.
That's right.
Not anymore.
They had a brutal, long, 15-year-long civil war.
And Hezbollah is still there.
And Hezbollah has rearmed itself, alas, since the last 2006 Lebanon war. And I think the estimates are that they have like 40,000 missiles.
When you crossed, were you aware of your identity and how you might be expected to behave on each side?
Well, you know, I realized that I was an American even as a young boy, but as a child, of course, while it may seem like I had a strange upbringing, as a child it seemed entirely normal to me. But I quickly, adopted the identity of an expatriate, an observer, which maybe is why I became a reporter later in life.
Did you speak Arabic or Hebrew?
I was initially sent to an Arabic language school in Jerusalem, in the Old City, and I picked up quite a bit of Arabic, but that didn't work out, and for that reason they eventually sent me to an English language school in West Jerusalem, inside Israel.
I'm assuming that you spoke more Arabic than your father did at the time, because later he actually had to learn to speak Arabic.
That's right. He was sent to a language school in America and in Beirut.
Did you feel that your family's experience was common among expatriates?
Oh, you know, there are thousands of American expatriates living in the Middle East. When we were living in Saudi Arabia, it was very surreal. We lived in a little compound for the consulate of 12 houses. But 2 miles down the road, there was a one-square-mile American camp, as they called it, where 6,000 Americans lived working for Aramco, the Arabian American Oil Company. And it was surrounded by a fence and one gate inside. And once you were inside it, you might think you were in a suburb of Houston, Texas, with ranch houses and green lawns and swimming pools and a softball field. But you were plunk in the middle of the desert of Arabia.
Well, you had gone back to Washington by that time, as your father learned how to speak Arabic, and you'd been in Beirut as well. When you went to Saudi Arabia, was that a culture shock? Because it's just so different.
It was a very primitive society in the early 60s. Bedouins would pitch their black tents right outside our compound, and camels and donkeys would wander through the compound as well. And yet, Arabia was even then adapting. It was jumping from the 17th century rapidly into the 20th century in an economic sense.
But not in other senses. Your mother must have felt very repressed.
Oh, well, she was allowed to drive a car, which is still not allowed in Saudi Arabia today. She was allowed to drive her car from the consulate compound 2 miles down the road to the American Aramco camp and to the airport 2 miles the other direction, but that's all.
Well, what was the role of Aramco in Saudi Arabian relations?
Well,
Saudi American relations.
Yes, it was very bizarre. I sort of paint the Americans in the American camp as the cowboys, and indeed many of them were oil drillers from Arkansas or Texas, and they wore cowboy boots, and the Saudis, by contrast, were the Indians, the natives, but it was the Indians who were keeping the Americans on a reservation, and it was a segregated relationship. They didn't have anything to do with each other in many ways.
Well, the Americans were trying to recreate a Western experience as much as they could. How did they deal with the prohibition against alcohol?
Ah, well, each ramekin had a still in their bathroom, and they brewed what they called siddiqui, which in Arabic is a reference to my friend. That's what they called their alcoholic brew, home brew.
My guest is Kai Bird, whose latest book is called Crossing Mandelbaum Gate, and it is published by Scribner. Why did it get the name Mandelbaum Gate?
When Israel achieved independence in the 1948 war, the war stopped at the armistice line when peace was declared. The line going through East and West Jerusalem literally divided the city in two, and there had been a major battle at what was called Mandelbaum House, which was a large house built by some immigrants from Belarus at the turn of the century. And they built this house of heavy, white, glistening Jerusalem stone, but it had been completely destroyed. And it just happened that they decided to make this the sort of diplomatic gate between the two, and so it was called Mandelbaum Gate.
But in effect, it's Checkpoint Charlie.
Yeah, it was Checkpoint Charlie, exactly.
In the beginning, didn't your parents sympathize with the Palestinians? Was that because they were living in an Arab country?
Well, actually, when they first arrived, they had a presumption, if anything, a sympathy for the new Israeli state, you know, for the notion that, the Jews had come to Palestine to make the desert bloom. They bought into that notion as well, but actually within 6 months their attitude had changed because they lived among the Palestinians in East Jerusalem. They picked up, they realized sort of they adopted a sympathy for the plight of the Palestinian refugees who at that time were still living, many of them in tents on the outskirts of Jerusalem.
Your father read George Antonius's book, The Arab Awakening?
Yes, like all young Foreign Service officers stationed in the Middle East, that was sort of the classic book to explain the Arab political situation.
On the other hand, the dominant figure in Arab politics at that time was Nasser, and he was cozying up to the Soviet Union. He was expanding his totalitarian powers. I would have thought that Americans would have seen him as if not the enemy, as a serious problem.
Well, they did so back home. And during the Eisenhower administration, John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, very much viewed Nasser as a threat. He was too neutral in this great game called the Cold War. But from the perspective of American diplomats stationed in the Middle East, they looked at Nasser and they saw something different. He was, after all, in retrospect, he was very much a secular Arab nationalist. His closest enemies at home were the Muslim Brotherhood. So today, from that perspective, he sort of looks like a man who we could have talked to and could have negotiated with. But in terms of the Cold War years, he was regarded as not cooperative enough.
Although during the invasion of, the Suez War, whatever we want to call that, the Suez Crisis, the Eisenhower administration sided with him.
Yes. This is perhaps forgotten by many Americans today, but the Suez War was a war initiated by England and France and colluded in with Israel, And they hoped to unseat Nasser, to destroy his regime.
Because he had seized the Suez Canal.
He had nationalized the Suez Canal. And so this was very much a sort of colonial war which Israel participated in. And Eisenhower thought that this kind of war of aggression just couldn't be tolerated at the very moment that the Soviets were invading Hungary.
Well, the argument on the other side was that the Suez Canal would be politicized and certain ships wouldn't be allowed to go through, and that's exactly what happened. In July 1965, your father began a 2-year stint in Cairo. How old were you at that point?
I was just turning 15, and so I started high school there. And
Have friends? Nasser was still in power at this point,
oh,
right?
Yes. Nasser was still very much in power. He had, he'd been elected president in a fairly fair democratic election. He was certainly overwhelmingly elected. But by 1965, he had become sort of a benevolent despot and had built a bumbling police state in many ways.
Well, your attitude had changed. You had almost worn a Nasser pin when you were crossing the Mandelbaum Gate at one point.
Oh, yes. When I was a young boy, one day I was crossing Mandelbaum Gate going to school and headed towards school in Jerusalem, in West Jerusalem. And we had just passed the Jordanian checkpoint, and I suddenly cried out to my father, "Stop the car, stop the car." And my father, startled, turned around and saw me groping at my T-shirt to try to take off a pin that had the image of Gamal Abdel Nasser on it that a childhood friend in East Jerusalem had given me. And I was so aware of the divisions and the borders and the animosities on both sides. In my childhood naivety, I thought wearing a Nasser pin would make me a target of the Israeli soldiers. So,
were there still Jews living in Egypt in 1965?
Oh, absolutely. This is perhaps forgotten, too, but up until the late 50s, nearly a majority of the population of the suburb that we lived in, a place called Mahdi, that had actually been founded at the turn of the century by two Jewish-Egyptian entrepreneurs, nearly half the population of Mahdi was Jewish until the late 50s. Many had to leave after the 56 war, but Egypt was then still very much a cosmopolitan place.
And then you had to evacuate in 67 because of the Six Days War.
Yes.
Another evacuation.
And
that kind of ended any Jewish presence in Egypt.
After the 67 war, the remaining Jewish Egyptians left.
And that was also the beginning of a serious deterioration in relations with the United States. Your father had learned Arabic and was an Arabist. We heard in the build-up to the war in Iraq that there was practically nobody in the State Department or in the military who could speak Arabic. What happened in the interim?
Well, at the end of World War II, I learned there were 6 trained Arabists in the State Department. And on the verge of the Iraq War of 2003, there were 6 trained Arabists who were still active diplomats. The State Department just hasn't invested in this language. It's a very difficult language to learn.
But it's such an important part of the world and has been considered an important part of the world for a long time. After all, pretty much every president during my lifetime has tried to work out some kind of a peace program for the area.
Yes.
And
all have foundered. All have foundered. It's a very intractable problem. And there is, I try to end the book on a hopeful note, but There are, I tell about going back to Jerusalem and looking up a childhood neighborhood friend named Sari Nusebi. And Sari is an Oxford-trained philosopher who is a Palestinian but is now head of president of Al-Quds University in East Jerusalem. And he and the retired head of Shin Bet, the Israeli intelligence organization, Ami Ayalon, came up with a plan in 2003, a single piece of paper, a 7-point plan, that I think is the obvious way to go. It's what should happen. It probably is what will happen eventually. A two-state solution with the Green Line, the 1967 border basically dividing the two states, with a one-to-one exchange of land to take into account new facts on the ground, and with Jerusalem being the shared capital.
And you've said that some people have criticized you for being naive with this solution. Some Americans, I just read an op-ed piece by somebody who said he had been committed to finding some kind of solution to the problem, and now he's thrown up his hands and said there is no solution. Because he thinks both sides have taken intractable positions.
Yes. Well, unfortunately, the extremists on both sides, the messianic elements of both the Palestinians and the Israelis, are driving the politics at the moment. But, you know, 250,000 Israelis have signed the Nusseibeh-Ayalon plan, which is regarded as sort of a citizens' initiative, and a slightly fewer number of Palestinians have done the same. So there is some hope.
Kai Bird's book, Crossing Mandelbaum Gate, Coming of Age Between the Arabs and Israelis, 1956 to 1978, is published by Scribner. And I hope you're right. I hope that we will see peace in the Middle East sometime in the near future, because the situation today seems to be almost impossible.
I hope so, too. I hope I'm not naive.